everyone. My name is Eric Bowe, and welcome to the Primal Shopper Podcast. This podcast is for marketers, entrepreneurs, and academics interested in understanding why we shop the way we do. My goal of each podcast is to look into primal motivations and what is driving shoppers' behaviors, and then how do you apply these learnings to improve your marketing? Don't worry about taking notes. I will include any links in the show notes, and also there is plenty of bonus content on primalshopper.com. Finally, if you want an in-depth perspective, I am publishing a book in March. Yep, it is that close, folks. I'll talk a little bit more about the publishing schedule at the end of this podcast. This episode is about the marketing funnel. Throughout my career, I've read many articles about the funnel and really how people view it. Some people view it as dead, which I find very interesting. You're trying to kill a metaphor. Other people like to invert it. Other people have looked at it like a toilet bowl where shoppers swirl around and around and around until ultimately they buy. I don't know if they got flushed, but they bought eventually. And my take today is really taking a look at the marketing funnel in regards to dating. That may seem like a bizarre combination, dating and the marketing funnel, but it works for me. I've used it throughout my career. And to bring this idea to life, to illustrate it, I'm going to talk about four different product categories: automotive, mobile phone, grocery, and restaurant. So let's get on with the episode. So let's start by talking about why do I use dating to describe the marketing funnel. Dating for most people is a very emotional relationship where you're trying to find the person ultimately you hope to marry or spend time with, you know, for quite a while. Marketing is probably less emotional unless you're the marketer, and then it becomes very emotional, specifically when people are not working through your funnel. Now, let's talk about a basic funnel here just as some groundwork for this episode. The basic funnel usually has about 5 steps: awareness, opinion, consideration, intent, and purchase. I've seen some funnels and more, but you get the idea. For the purposes of today, these 5 steps are fine. Now, a marketer's belief is that they can control this funnel. And by applying advertising, marketing, and promotions, they can inch shoppers through the funnel to ultimately buy their product. And I've been in many, many meetings where the discussion was, how do we fill the funnel? How do we move them from opinion to consideration? And then from consideration on? Well, here's the reality. The shoppers are in control of the funnel. And there's a simple fact that I want to stress here on why they're in control of the funnel. Shoppers break up with brands by choosing to not buy them, while brands never break up with shoppers. I've yet to come across a brand that says to a shopper, nope, I'm good, you can take your business elsewhere. This stark reality between what a marketer believes they can do and what the shoppers are really doing within their shopper journey is sort of the fundamentals of my discussion today. First, let me just illuminate this a little bit by talking about, I'm going to call it the Ford funnel. About a decade ago, I was working on Ford, and one of the things we were doing was trying to push people through the funnel. And this is before the bailout and everything, so Ford was not really in a good place. And we looked at the funnel, we analyzed the funnel, we triaged the funnel, and we noticed something very interesting. At consideration, there was a major drop-off as far as flow. People tended to leave at consideration. So being researchers, being strategists, what we did is, hey, let's look at the data. There's a study out there called NVCS, New Vehicle Customer Sat Study, that takes a look at a lot of different variables on why people purchase versus another. So we analyzed the crap out of that thing. And what we did is we pinpointed 4 different attributes that we believe were causing people to not go past consideration. And there were things like green or eco-conscious technology and the sort. So we figured, hey, why not market these 4 factors, and that should fill the funnel further and boost people past consideration. So we did that. All the marketing, all of the web advertising, everything we did was really focused on these 4 pillars. About a year goes by, look at the data again, no difference. It was a little frustrating to say the least. fast forward a few months and I was on a different project. I was working on how to rethink the overall approach to buying a car. So as a part of this, I was interviewing dealers and salespeople to understand what worked and what didn't in the dealership. And really, how can we optimize our marketing to get better results, to get better qualified traffic into the dealership? The funny part is what I found in this actually was the answer to the first problem of the funnel. And I dealt with a salesperson who was telling me that corporate really didn't get it. And I was intrigued by this because anytime somebody tells me they don't get it, there's usually a truth to it. Maybe not an absolute, but a truth nonetheless. And what he said was interesting. He said, look, what I'm getting is a lot of people coming in here and it's down to $10 a month. Meaning people are switching or choosing a vehicle based on a monthly payment of $10 between competitive vehicles. So for example, he had people coming in cross-shopping the F-150 with Silverado and with Dodge Ram. What was happening was these people were making a choice by as little as $10 a month. Now this is disturbing if you're a marketer, meaning that if it's down to $10 a month, that means your brand has been commoditized with the competition and it's all about price now. So no matter what we did in the upper funnel, it wasn't going to make a difference because it didn't deal with the price sensitivity of the shopper at that dealership. The reality of the story brings to light the fact that the shoppers are in control. Sure, you can influence them, but ultimately the shopper and their primal motivations are going to dictate the final purchase. Now there's something else going on with the funnel too. Remember, the funnel had five parts: awareness, opinion, consideration, intent, purchase. Something funny happens at the consideration phase. People tend to go from thinking to behaving or doing. So up to consideration, you're sort of contemplating your next purchase attitudinally. You're thinking about options. You know, it's sort of a very fluid process of what vehicles you're considering or not. Then you start shopping. And all of a sudden, certain realities come to light. Realities like down payment. Realities like, what is my monthly payment? Realities like, what is my trade-in? And finally, the last reality is insurance. All these factors tend to affect a shopper, especially if they're a deal seeker. They're looking for a specific monthly payment. Could be $200, $300, $400. Now, whether it's lease or buy is immaterial, that's their bogey. That's what they want to get to. So unless you can get to that bogey or at least close to it, you're probably not going to win the race. And worse yet, if your brand is commoditized with others, you're in a rough place because now it is all about price. And the only way to win that price war is to throw money on the hood or offer them a deal they can't walk away from. So if I were to pick a classic cliche breakup line for this story about Ford, it would be the shopper saying to Ford, hey, look, it's not you, it's me, and we just need to go our separate ways. Let me switch gears from automotive and let's talk about a mobile phone funnel. My experience with this was during a Radio Shack pitch. I think it might have been the last Radio Shack agency pitch between McCann and Gray. And the interesting thing about it was Radio Shack was in dire straits and they were trying to carve out a reason to exist. And the reason, which was part of this pitch, was let's be the epicenter for mobile phone buying. You know, if you got to pick something, it's not bad because at the time, a lot of people were going to smartphones. They were confusing. A lot of things were going on. So owning that space was not a bad idea, or at least they thought. As a part of the research for the pitch, I did a behavioral funnel. And this is different than the classical funnel I talked about earlier. This funnel had four steps. The first step was just asking people, did you even consider going to this retail brand, in this case, Radio Shack? The second one was you considered going to the retail brand, but you did not visit. The third one, visited but did not buy. And finally, you purchased from that retail brand. We looked at Radio Shack and a lot of the competition, including Best Buy, a lot of the carriers. And something shocking came out of this. This move to mobile phones was not a good move for Radio Shack, especially when we looked at it behaviorally. And let me get into why. Well, let's start with the first step, did not consider. Now, what's interesting is 71% of the people did not even consider going to Radio Shack for a new mobile phone. Best Buy did not fare much better because they were only at 59%. However, when you looked at the carriers, only 20% did not consider going to them. And let's just talk about the last one. I could go through the whole funnel, but let's just talk about the last behavioral touch point, and that is purchase. Only 6% bought from Radio Shack, 8% bought from Best Buy, and 46% bought from a carrier store. If you could visualize this, Best Buy and Radio Shack looked like your classical funnel, very wide on the top, and it got very small on the bottom. The carriers were inverted, very small, or smaller, excuse me, on the top, and it got bigger until you finally got to purchase. Now, the reason why is somewhat self-evident. Who do you have a relationship with in regards to your cellular? And that is your cellular service. And a lot of people believed that they had to go back to their cellular service to get their phone or switch to another service and they would buy phones that way. The reality was, this isn't really true. You can buy a phone from anywhere, and Radio Shack at the time offered a lot of different carrier options. So in essence, it was like a superstore in a small location where you could go in and get all your phone needs. Unfortunately, nobody was listening because this relationship between the customer and the carrier was very strong. So what was the solution? Well, the solution we proposed had to be stark, had to be interrupt, had to get people to think about Radio Shack as a mobile destination, where we ended up with this idea called nomophobia. And let me explain nomophobia a little bit. Nomophobia comes from a UK study where these researchers took mobile phones away from people. Roughly about 75% suffered severe anxiety when their mobile phone was taken away. And nomophobia stands for no mobile phone. Now, this is interesting when you combine it with the fact that in the study, we also found out 24% of the people replaced their phones because it was lost, broken, or stolen. So that's a 25% of the population that you can actually affect. And everybody can sort of relate to the fact you lose your phone and it can be very stressful. So what we wanted Radio Shack to be was the cure for nomophobia. The idea was simple but powerful, and nobody was doing it at the time. And it went something like, hey, if you ever lose your phone, we're the cure for nomophobia. Within 1 hour, we will get your phone up and going and get you back on your way so you can get on with your life. To this day, I don't think anybody has really done this. And it's a very interesting tactic to take within the mobile phone market because, again, roughly 25% of the people experience this. So really, it's a solution that they didn't adopt. I don't know if it really would have saved them anyway, but nonetheless, it was an interesting view into the behavioral funnel of the mobile phone shopper. So let's jump over and talk about grocery shopping and the funnel there. Now, the interesting thing here is the best way to talk about grocery shopping is it's like an open marriage from a dating perspective, meaning that shoppers aren't really married to one store. They usually use more than one store. I can look at different stats. For example, with MPD, they say that roughly 75% of grocery shoppers out there shop at two or more grocery stores. And it sort of makes sense. Some of this could just be convenience related, but there are other reasons. And that is especially when we look at the deal seeker. Deal seekers, true deal seekers, exert the effort to get the best deal. That means they comb multiple grocery stores to figure out who has the best price for what they need either this week or this month, and then they go out and buy it. Now, if you're a grocery brand, this is somewhat disconcerting because your goal is to increase the share of cart. And this becomes difficult when your customers are using you as one of the different stores they go to. So how do you increase the share of cart when you know that they're looking at the entire landscape? Well, the best way to do this is move up from just a selection in a circular or a selection online to own the list. And to own the list, we need to look at really how are people building the list, specifically the deal seeker. And deal seekers build lists two different ways. The first way is they write down everything they need and they do an inventory, household inventory. And what they do then is go and look either online or in an insert and find out who has the best prices for what they need this week. The second way a deal seeker will do this is still make the list, but then what they do is they look through these inserts and online to find the best deals. And if they find a deal on a shelf-stable product or a stock-up product, they will add it to their list and they will buy it that week. A personal example for me was actually last night. I went grocery shopping for the week And Kroger had their 5 for $5. So if I buy 5 participating items, I save $5. And I usually wait for this because what I'll do is then I'll stock up on laundry detergent. I'll stock up on frozen goods, things that have a longer shelf life. Ended up spending roughly about $240 in grocery, but I saved $60 by maximizing this 5 for $5. So it gives you an example sort of that latter part of how people will add to their list. So what are some possible solutions to own the list from a grocery shopper perspective? One way in is through meal planning. Roughly about 50% of the people do meal planning when they build their list. And you can use different tactics to become part of their meal planning. Probably the most dominant tactic all grocers do is own the center of the plate. And this, the center of the plate, is typically the meat that the menu planner builds their menu around. So whether it's pork, chicken, steak, fish, these are the go-to items that people start with first because typically they're the most expensive part of the meals. Next time you're looking at an insert, check out how the meat and fish are treated versus the other products within the insert. And what you'll typically see is that it's a larger picture, a bolder, bigger typeface to get the shopper's attention and say, hey, we got a deal. Fundamentally, here's the problem though. You can't list all the items in the store, nor do you typically put all the center of the plate items on sale. So depending on what meal you want to make that week, it's a hit or miss from the grocery brand on whether they're relevant or not. Which gets to the second idea, marketing through recipes. I've seen Walmart do this and Kroger do this infrequently. And what they would do is put the recipe within the insert to give people ideas. Now, it seems like a smart tactic, but fundamentally you run into the issue of that's your idea of a recipe. And in my household, everybody has different taste patterns. And I have 2 teenagers who, no matter what we make, they seem to not like it. So while it's okay to offer up recipe ideas, the reality is you need to figure out how to get integrated into the meal planning, which gets me to the last idea, which is the meal planning app. I'm surprised no grocer has really done this yet, because meal planning is more than recipes. Think about it this way. In the past week, how many things did you create from scratch? The majority of people don't cook from recipes for every meal. Sometimes they'll do a recipe. Sometimes they'll do a box meal. Sometimes they'll pull a frozen pizza out and throw it in the oven. That's still a meal. And the meal planning app needs to understand that scenario in order to meet the needs of the meal planner. So the meal planning app is less about, hey, here's a recipe to do, which you still should have in there, and more about, here are different things you can make into a meal. So I can just buy a DiGiorno's pizza, a salad bag, garlic bread, there's a meal. And this is interesting because we live in a time-deprived society. And often we think everybody is doing things right. And although there's aspirations to cook from scratch and stuff like that, the life's reality takes over and we spend more time eating out than we should. And we spend time eating more processed food than we should. The meal planning app has to be less about what we should do and more about the way we truly do meal planning. One last point on the meal planning app, which I still don't know why people haven't done this yet, is that there's online services that offer up meal planning, and you could pay, I don't know, $10, $15 a month for these services. If a grocer was to go out and create one for free and pulling in their products, their SKUs, it would give them a leg up on the competition. They would go from just one of the stops in the open marriage to maybe a true marriage. And it would be done on 3 levels. First of all, most likely, they would become the first stop for the shopper. So you still would get all the meals, but you would probably get a lot of the ancillary items also. Secondly, you would probably increase the frequency. And then finally, you would increase your overall share of cart. So that's a little bit on grocery shopping. Let's move on to the next one, and let's talk about the restaurant variety funnel. While some people who frequent restaurants are loyal to a restaurant or two, most of the people like a rotation. Primary reason is variety, but there could be some other ones out there. For example, looking at some research in fast casual, Panera's rotation looks something like this. About a third of the people who go to Panera are exclusive to Panera. About 2/3, though, went to other fast casual restaurants. The top 3 here were Five Guys, Chipotle, and Jimmy John's. That was your top overlap brands. And the reasons for this rotation vary a little bit. I talked about variety already. a lot of people like to try different things or what they're in the mood for. So whether it's Mexican, Chinese, Asian, or American food or burger, the palate tends to drive where you go. The crave drives where you go. Another factor is dinner party influence. So whether it's going with coworkers or with a family, there's this social debate on where you should go. Often it can be very frustrating because it seems like a circular debate on where you should go until somebody ultimately gives up and you come to a conclusion, not because you really wanted to go there, but because you just caved in. Well, maybe I'm describing my household and how it goes, but I'm sure others experience something similar. Another reason is by day part. And if you look at breakfast/morning, lunch, and dinner, there's something different going on with each one of these. In the morning, most people are on their way to work, so it's really like a drive-by solution. They're a mission shopper. So I'm hitting a Starbucks drive-thru or a Tim Hortons drive-thru or something like that. It could be a McDonald's. But the goal is to get my breakfast on the way, get my coffee on the way, get there. The next thing is lunch. Lunch is often with coworkers, or it could be you on a mission too to get something and get back to work. But with the coworkers, it gets into this dinner party influence, or in this case, lunch party influence, of who went where, who likes what. And then, like the discussion before, you're trying to gain a consensus on where you go on that day. And if you go with the same people throughout the week, you may go to the same restaurant, but most likely what's going to happen is there's some variety here based on, well, you decided last time, I'm going to decide this time. And the end result is you're hitting different restaurants based on the different times you go. Finally, the last day part is dinner time. The interesting part about dinner time is you have more time and you're usually going with the same people, whether it's friends or family. And what occurs is, similar to lunchtime, you get into that circular debate until somebody concedes. In the first scenario, the morning, it's less about rotation and more about a mission. And really what you're going to see here is that mission shopper mentality that's going on. And you will not get as much variety because it's become habitual. The other two, lunchtime and dinner, you're going to get more of a variety because there's more inputs, there's more people involved, there's different taste patterns. Understanding this, what is the restaurant brand's goal? Well, it's threefold. First and foremost, you got to get in the rotation. Secondly, you want to increase the frequency. So if you're getting people one time a month, can you get them a second time? And if two, third times, you get it. Last but not least, you want to increase the spend on each visit. So how can I get you to you spend more or actually bring more people with you to increase the ticket size? Given these goals, how can we get to a solution? Well, the first thing I would argue is you need to understand the primal shopper typologies that are influencing these decisions. And let me give you an example back to fast casual. The comfort zoner, which is brand citizen, price blind, journey, is the largest, by far the largest typology within fast casual. So if you want to increase your market share within fast casual, you need to appeal to these comfort zoners. How do you do that? Well, there's an interesting insight about the comfort zoner, and they're what I call a behavioral foodie. Now, a behavioral foodie is different than what I would call a self-identified foodie. So, for example, you can ask people, are you a foodie? And they can say yes. And really, it's more of how they describe themselves. A behavioral foodie does specific behaviors that actually buckets them into this category. And those behaviors are things like they created a new recipe in the last 2 weeks. They subscribe to a food publication, or they read food blogs, or they possibly have taken a culinary class recently. Now, the behavioral foodie is interesting on two levels. One, if you can get them, obviously it meets your needs of getting in the rotation, increase the frequency, and on and on and on. But there's more to this. Because they're a behavioral foodie, they tend to be more influential. So by getting them in, what you're also going to do is gain their social circle. And this is very important to understand. While you can argue every customer is important, I would argue some customers are far more important to your business, especially if they're influencers. So how do you get these comfort zoners? How do you get these behavioral foodies? Well, it starts with what I will call an Epicurious crave. And this is a little different than the crave you would get at a Taco Bell or something that is more, I'll call primal is crave, meaning I just need food and God, that looks good. This is more about ingredients. This is more about, I don't want to say chef-like tendencies. I saw an ad the other day from Panera, and they do a good job with this. What they're doing is they're talking about their soup, and all their soup is made from prime ingredients. They're really feeding into that behavioral foodie, no pun intended, that they appeal to that idea of it's made a certain way that is superior than the rest. Marketing this way is smart because it moves people attitudinally, but you still have to deliver behaviorally and really fulfill that down to actually eating in the restaurant. And something here has to occur, meaning that if you just have the same menu again and again and again, you get tired, you get boring, you're leaning into becoming stale when people are looking for variety. And this is an important point, that while you can do premium ingredients and a premium methods to making it like Panera does, you still have to have that rotation within your menu to be fresh, to be seen different. Maybe it's seasonal. Regardless, variety is important, not only in the rotation of the shopper, but into also how restaurant brands view their menu. One last subject I'd like to cover is couponing. Couponing works, without a doubt. The problem is it's a slippery slope, and it becomes an addiction, both for the brand and the customer. You're switching from appealing to somebody who's price blind, potentially, and now you're looking at somebody who's a deal seeker. And the deal seeker is loyal to the deal. The minute you take that deal out, it is a very good chance you will lose that customer. So you got to be very careful using couponing and deals. Now, you may be in a category like quick serve restaurants where it's all about the deal. So you do have to do deal advertising, the $1, the $2, the $3 type of options to remain top of mind, to fuel that desire to eat inexpensively. So what tactics should you use if you're a restaurant brand? Well, it gets back to my example with the comfort zoners. You need to look at your core typologies within the category to understand how big are the deal seeker typologies, the bargainistas, the deal surgeons, versus the price blind ones, the comfort zoners, the loyalty lasers. By understanding this, you get an idea of if I'm going to increase market share, I can look at these typologies and understand how I need to market to that shopper's primal motivations to get them to come to my brand versus others. So let's just wrap up this discussion by asking a simple question. What does your dating funnel look like? Is there a large gap at consideration where people are thinking about you, but then when it comes down to shopping, you just fall off the radar immediately? Is it like the behavioral funnel in the mobile phone example, where you're honestly not even on radar and you really need to take a look at how you can find a niche to become relevant and increase that consideration? Otherwise, you're going no further. In grocery, we talked about an open marriage. Do you live in a category where people use multiple stores or multiple locations to actually fulfill their needs on a regular basis? And last but not least, is your category a rotation category where it's about variety, where people actually go from one to the option to the next to get that variety, that different spice of life? Regardless of your rotation, I hope you enjoyed this episode. So that pretty much wraps it up. First off, thanks for listening. Second of all, I sort of want to touch on the status of my book. I'm very excited. Talked to my publisher last week. We're looking at being on Amazon in the upcoming weeks as far as pre-ordering, and then the book will be available sometime later in March for purchase. So I'll keep you up to date on that. And if you enjoy this podcast, I encourage you to subscribe to future episodes on PrimalShopper.com or subscribe on your favorite podcast services like iTunes, Spotify, or Google. Also, if you're looking to apply Primal Shopper to your marketing, I would be happy to help you out, whether it's just answering questions or a full engagement. My contact information is on PrimalShopper.com. Well, that's it for now. Until next time, this is Eric Bowe on the Primal Shopper Podcast.